The little girl in the pink coat was drowning. Elizabeth would have loved that little girl. He could hear Elizabeth crying out, "Run, Harry, run!" He ran from Jamie's room onto the landing. It was like he had his old body back. There was no pain. He felt exhilarated by the urgency of his mission. He was running gracefully, fluidly, like a 20-year-old with perfect limber knees. He could do this. He was fast. He was nimble. He'd save her. On the second step, he fell. He grabbed for the banister to save himself, but it was too late. He was flying, like his wife and son. Chapter 84. It was early evening at the end of another beautiful day, and Sam was walking home from the ferry beneath an indigo sky. There had been almost a whole week of clear weather now. Everything had dried out and dried off, and people had stopped discussing how nice it was to see the sun. The big wet was drifting away from everyone's memories on a gentle spring breeze. Sam had just had another fairly productive day at work, so that was something. It was a little embarrassing just how much nerdy satisfaction he had achieved today from successfully completing his proposed strategic plan for preventing the further loss of market share in the now crowded, sugar-free, berry-flavoured, caffeinated energy drink segment. He hadn't exactly composed a symphony, but it was a well-thought-out strategy that would make the company money, which would make up for the last few weeks when he'd sat at his desk being paid for doing nothing. He'd used his brain. He'd ticked off a task. It felt good. Maybe it was all due to the amazing magical effects of his first counselling session. After the humiliating incident at the first aid course on Sunday, Clementine had arranged an appointment with a counsellor after hours on Monday. Sam didn't ask her how she managed to get an appointment so quickly. She'd probably got her mother on the case. Pam was a big fan of counselling. She probably had one on speed dial. Sam cringed at the thought of his mother-in-law's softly sympathetic face as Clementine told her about his tears, his so-called post-traumatic stress, for Christ's sake. The counsellor was a cheery, chatty little fellow, like a jockey, and he had plenty of opinions, which surprised Sam. Weren't they meant to say enigmatic things like, "What do you think?" He said Sam probably did have a mild case of PTSD. He said it in the same nonchalant tone as if he'd said, "You've probably got a mild sinus infection." He reckoned Sam would need only 3 or 4 sessions, max, to knock this on the head. Sam had left his office almost laughing. Did this guy get his qualifications online? But as he'd stood in the lift going back to the lobby, he'd been surprised to find he was experiencing just a mild sense of relief. Like standing in the baggage claim area after a long flight and feeling your ears pop when you weren't fully aware they'd been blocked. It wasn't like he felt great, just marginally better. Maybe it was the placebo effect, or maybe it was going to happen eventually anyway, or maybe his little counsellor had special powers. Now he stopped at a pedestrian crossing and watched a woman with a baby in a stroller and a preschool-aged kid. The baby was about 1. He was sitting up, fat legs straight out in front of him, a large green leaf clutched in his chubby hand, like a flag. Was it a floating leaf that had attracted Ruby's attention that day? He imagined it, as he'd done so many times before, as maybe he was going to do for the rest of his life. He saw her climbing up onto the edge of the fountain, proud of herself, walking around the perimeter, maybe even running. Did she slip? Or did she see something she wanted? A floating leaf or an interesting-looking stick? Something that sparkled. He imagined her on her knees on the side of the fountain, in her little pink coat, her hand outstretched, and then suddenly, silently toppling in. Head first, panicking, flailing, her lungs filling with water as she tried to scream, "Daddy!" The heavy coat dragging her down, and then the stillness, her hair floating around her head. For a moment, Sam's world tipped, and his breath caught. He concentrated on the "don't walk" light in red, waiting for it to change to walk. The car zoomed by. The mother waiting next to him was talking on her mobile phone. "My shoe is falling off," whined the preschooler. "No, it's not," said the mother distractedly as she continued to speak into the phone. "I know, that's the thing. I mean, it would be fine if she'd just been upfront about it from the beginning, but Lachlan, no, don't take off your shoe here." The little boy had suddenly plonked himself down on the footpath and was in the process of removing his shoe. "He's taking off his damn shoe in the middle of the street. Lachlan, stop that. I said stop that." The woman bent down to drag the preschooler back to his feet. Her hand left the stroller handle. It was on a slope that led straight out onto the street. The stroller began to roll. "Whoops!" Sam reached out one hand and caught hold of the handle. The woman looked up. "Jesus Christ!" The phone slid from beneath her head and shoulder and crashed onto the ground as she stood up fast and grabbed the stroller handle, her hand overlapping Sam's. She looked at the traffic roaring by and then back down at the stroller. She said, "It could have. He could have." "I know," said Sam. "But it's all good. It didn't." He removed his hand from under hers. She had the handle in a death grip now. "Mummy, the phone is all cracked." The preschooler held up the phone he'd rescued from the ground with an expression of pure horror on his face. Sam could hear a tinny voice calling out from the phone, "Hello? Hello?" The lights changed to walk. The woman didn't move. She was still processing it, still seeing what could have been. "Have a good night," said Sam, and he crossed the road to go home, the sky huge and hopeful before him. Chapter 85. "You don't have to rush back to the office, do you?" said Oliver as he tucked his ears into his swimming cap, snap, snap, and pulled his goggles down over his eyes so he looked to Erica like a goofy alien. They had met for their lunch break at North Sydney Pool, which was within walking distance of both their offices, for their first swim after their brief winter hiatus, as Oliver liked to call it. During the winter months, they swapped their swim for a 30-minute high-intensity cardio class at the gym. "As long as I'm back by 1:30, Erica pulled down her own goggles so that the world turned turquoise. "Good," said Oliver. He seemed serious. As Erica swam her first lap, she wondered what was on his mind. Ever since his discovery of her habit, she felt like she'd been demoted to junior partner in their marriage. He'd made her promise to talk about her kleptomania with her psychologist. "It's not kleptomania," Erica cried. "It's just stealing your friend's stuff." finished Oliver brightly. There was something different about Oliver lately. A kind of recklessness. Except not really, because Oliver would never be reckless. Almost aggressiveness, but not quite. Feistiness. It was not unattractive, to be honest. They were having a lot of angry sex. It was great. She hadn't yet discussed her kleptomania with her psychologist because she hadn't seen her. Not Pat had cancelled a few sessions recently at the last minute. She probably had her own personal problems. Erica secretly hoped she might be forced to take a sabbatical. As she turned her head for every second breath, she looked up and saw the grey arched pylons of the harbour bridge soaring into the bright blue sky above them. It was an amazing place to swim. Wasn't this enough for a life? Good work, good exercise, good sex. She tumble-turned and looked for Oliver. He was way ahead of her, powering through the water. Lucky it wasn't too busy, because he was swimming too fast, even for the fast lane. It would be the baby. That's what he would want to talk about. The baby was his project, and his project management skills were excellent. Now that Clementine was no longer part of the picture, he would want to explore other options, other avenues. He would want to talk through the pros and the cons. Erica's whole body slowed in the water at the thought. Her legs felt like limp weights she was dragging along behind her. The thought occurred to her, I'm done. I'm done with the baby project. But of course, she couldn't be done. Not until Oliver was done. This was simply the wall. Every time you ran a marathon, you hit a wall. The wall was both a physical and a mental barrier, but it could be overcome. Carb loading, hydration, focus on your technique. She swam on. It didn't feel like she could get past this, but that was the nature of the wall. After their swim, they sat in the sun outside a cafe, looking straight out onto the harbour, eating tuna and kale salads for their lunch. Back in their suits, sunglasses on, hair just slightly damp at the ends. I'm going to send you a link to an article, said Oliver. I read it yesterday and I've been thinking about it. Thinking about it a lot. Okay, said Erica. Some new reproductive technology. Great. It's just the wall, she told herself. Breathe. It's about fostering, said Oliver. Fostering older children. Fostering? Erica's fork stopped halfway to her mouth. It's about how hard it is, said Oliver. It's about how people get this really romantic idea about fostering, and it's not like that at all. It's about how most foster carers have no idea what they're getting themselves into. It's a brutally honest article. Oh, said Erica. She couldn't see his eyes because of his sunglasses. She was aware of the feeling of a tiny spark of hope quelled. So the reason you're sending it to me is, I think we should do it, said Oliver. You think we should do it? Repeated Erica. I was thinking about Clementine and Sam, said Oliver, and how Ruby's accident affected them so badly. Do you want to know why it was such a big thing for those two? He didn't wait for an answer. Because nothing bad has ever happened to them before. Well, said Erica, considering, I don't know if that's entirely, but you and me, we expect the worst, said Oliver. We've got low expectations. We're tough. We can handle stuff. Can we? Said Erica. She didn't know if she should remind him that she was in therapy. Everybody wants the babies, said Oliver, ignoring her. The cute little babies. But what they really need is foster parents for the older kids. The angry ones. The broken ones. He stopped, and suddenly he seemed to lose confidence. He picked up his superfood smoothie. I just thought, well, I thought maybe we could consider it, because maybe we'd have an understanding, or at least an inkling, of what those kids are going through. He sucked on his straw. She could see the harbour reflected in his sunglasses. Erica ate her salad and thought of Clementine's parents. She saw Pam making up the stretcher bed for her to stay the night, yet again, flicking her wrists so that the crisp white sheets floated in the air. The beautiful, clean fragrance of bleach was still Erica's favourite smell in the world. She saw Clementine's dad sitting in the passenger seat of his car while Erica sat in the driver's seat for the first time. He showed her how to put her hands at 3:15 on the steering wheel. Everyone else says 10 to 2, he says, but everyone else is wrong. She still drove with her hands at 3:15. What was that phrase people used? Pay it forward. So let's say we do it, said Erica. We take on one of these broken kids. Oliver looked up. Let's say we do. According to this article, it's going to be terrible. That's what it says, agreed Oliver. Traumatic. Stressful. Awful. We might fall in love with a kid who ends up going back to a biological parent. We might have a kid with terrible behavioural issues. We might find our relationship is tested in ways we could never imagine. Erica wiped her mouth with her napkin and stretched her arms high above her head. The sun warmed the top of her scalp, giving her a sensation of molten warmth. Or it might be great, she said. Yeah, said Oliver. He smiled. I think it might be great. Chapter 86. Do you want distracting talk? Said Sam as he drove her into the city. Or calming silence? I don't know, said Clementine. I can't decide. It was a little after 10 on a Saturday morning. Her audition wasn't until 2. The 10 minutes past 10 leaving time had been calculated to take into account anything that could possibly go wrong. I can drive myself, Clementine had told Sam last night. What are you talking about? Said Sam. I always drive you to your auditions. She thought with mild surprise, so we're still us, then. Maybe they were, although they still went off each night to sleep in separate rooms. Something had changed over the last week since the first aid course. Nothing dramatic. In fact, the opposite. It was as though a feeling of utter mundanity had settled upon them, like the start of a new season, fresh and familiar all at once. All the anger and recriminations had gone, drained away. It reminded Clementine of that feeling when you were recovering from being ill, when the symptoms were gone, but you still felt light-headed and peculiar. The girls were with Clementine's parents today, and they were both in fine form. Holly had come home from school yesterday with a merit certificate for excellent behaviour in class, which Clementine suspected was really a merit certificate for no longer behaving like a crazy person in class. The old Holly is back, her teacher had told Clementine in the playground, and she'd done a little, phew, swipe of the back of her hand across her forehead, which made Clementine think that Holly's behaviour at school must have been much worse than she or Sam had been made aware. Ruby had said Whisk could stay home today and have a little rest. She appeared to be losing interest in Whisk. Clementine could already see how poor Whisk was going to slip unobtrusively from their lives, like friends sometimes did. Okay, so there's no need to panic because we've allowed enough time for exactly this possibility, said Sam, as the traffic on the bridge came to a stop and a neon sign flashed in urgent red letters, "Incident ahead. Expect delays." Clementine breathed in deeply through her nostrils and out through her mouth. "I'm fine," she said. "I'm not thrilled, but I'm fine." Sam held out his palms as if in meditation. "We are Zen masters." Clementine studied the crisp white curves of the opera house's sails against the blue sky. Thankfully, the opera house was one of the venues where she knew she'd be given her own warm-up room, and she wouldn't have to share with other cellists, or worse, talk to the chatty ones. There were plenty of dressing rooms available, some with harbour views. It would be a comfortable, pleasant process. Her audition would be in the rarefied atmosphere of the concert hall. She looked back at the road. The traffic inched forward past two cars with crushed bonnets. There were police and an ambulance with the back doors open, and a man in a suit sat on the curb with his head in his hands. "Erica said something the other day and it sort of stuck with me," said Clementine. She hadn't been planning to say this, but all of a sudden she was saying it, as if she'd been subconsciously planning it. "What's that?" said Sam warily. She said, "I choose my marriage." "She chooses her marriage? What does that mean?" said Sam. "That doesn't make sense. She chooses her marriage over what?" "I think it does make sense," said Clementine. "It's about making a choice to make your marriage your priority, to kind of put that at the top of the page, as your mission statement or something." "Clementine Hart, are you actually using soulless corporate jargon right now?" said Sam. "Be quiet. I just want to take this opportunity to say," Sam snorted, "now you sound like your mother making one of her speeches." "I want to take this opportunity to say that I choose my marriage too."
Thanks?
Clementine spoke rapidly. "So if, for example, having a third child is your heart's desire, then that's something we need to at least talk about. I can't just ignore it or hope you'll forget about it, which was what I was doing, to be honest. I know when I asked you a couple of weeks ago, you said you didn't want another child, but that was when you were still, or when we were both still, kind of crazy," finished Sam for her. "Do you want another child?" he said. "I really don't," said Clementine. "But if you really do, then we need to talk about it."
"What? And then we work out whether I want a baby more than you don't want a baby?" said Sam.
"Exactly," said Clementine. "I think that's exactly what we do."
"I did want a third child," said Sam. "But now, well, it's just not something I'm thinking about right now."
"I know," said Clementine. "I know, but we could, we might, one day, not forget, of course, but we might forgive. We might forgive ourselves."
Anyway, I don't know why I brought that up today. It's not like we even have sex anymore, sleep in the same bed, say, I love you anymore. I guess I just thought I should put that on the table, she said. Consider it tabled, said Sam. Great. You know what my heart's desire is right now? Said Sam. What? It's for you to get this job. Right, said Clementine. I don't want you going onto that stage thinking about babies. I want you thinking about whatever it is you need to think about. Intonation, pitch, tempo, whatever those Nancy Boy ex-boyfriends of yours would have told you to think about. Well, I'll do my best, said Clementine. She said softly, You're a good man, Samuel. I know I am. Eat your banana, said Sam. No, said Clementine. You sound just like your daughter. Which one? Both of them, actually. The traffic was moving freely now. After a moment, Sam cleared his throat and said, I'd like to take this opportunity to say that I choose my marriage too. Oh, yes? And what does that mean? I have no idea. I just wanted to make my position clear. Maybe it means you don't want to sleep in the study anymore, suggested Clementine, her eyes on the road ahead. Maybe it does, said Sam. Clementine studied his profile. Would you like to come back? I'd like to come back, said Sam. He looked over his shoulder to change lanes. From wherever the hell I've been. Well, said Clementine, you're very welcome to submit an application. I could audition, he said. I have some smooth moves. He paused. You could be blindfolded. We'll make it a blind audition, so there is no possibility of bias. She could feel a wild, raw sense of happiness growing within her. It was just silly, cheesy, flirty talk, but it was their silly, cheesy, flirty talk. She already knew how it would be tonight, the sweet familiarity and the sharp, clean edges. Because of what they'd nearly lost. She didn't know how close their marriage had got to hitting that iceberg. Close enough to feel its icy shadow. But they'd missed it. Yeah, I choose my marriage. Sam swung the car to the right. And I also temporarily choose this illegal bus lane because I am one crazy motherfucker. Clementine reached into her bag, took out her banana, and peeled it. You'll get a ticket, she said, as she took a mouthful and waited for those natural beta blockers to take effect. And it must have been a really good season for bananas, because it was the best banana she'd ever tasted. Chapter 87. At 3:30, they finally called for her. She walked down the strip of carpet with her cello and bow to the lonely chair. She blinked in the bright, hot, white light. A woman coughed behind the black screen, and it sounded a little like Ainsley. Clementine sat. She embraced her cello. She nodded at her pianist. He smiled. She'd hired her own pianist to accompany her. Grant Morton was a grandfatherly man who lived alone with an adult daughter with Down syndrome. His wife had died the day after her 50th birthday, only last year, but he still had the sweetest smile of anyone she knew, and she'd been so glad he was available, because she wanted to start her audition with that sweet smile. She was conscious of her heart beating rapidly as she tuned, but it wasn't racing out of control. She breathed and put her hand to the tiny metallic stickers stuck on the collar of her shirt. "This is for good luck for your audition," Holly had said when they were leaving today, and she'd carefully put a purple butterfly sticker on her mother's shirt, and then, with great grown-up ceremony, she had kissed Clementine on the cheek.
"I want good luck too," Ruby had yelled, as if good luck was a treat being handed out by Clementine, and she'd copied everything her sister had done, except her sticker was a yellow smiley face, and her kiss was very wet and peanut buttery. Clementine could still feel its sticky imprint on her cheek. She took one deep breath and looked at the music on her stand. It was all there within her. The hours and hours of early morning practice, the listening to recordings, the dozens of tiny technical decisions she'd settled upon. She saw her little girls running about under the fairy lights, Vid throwing back his head and laughing, the chair lying on its side, Oliver's locked hands over Ruby's chest, the black shadow of the helicopter, her mother's enraged face close to hers. She saw her 16-year-old self standing up and walking off the stage. She saw a boy in a badly fitting tuxedo watch her pack away her cello and say, "I bet you wish you chose the flute." She saw the look of disbelief on Erica's face when Clementine first sat down opposite her in the playground. She remembered Mariana saying, "Don't just play for them, perform." She remembered Hugh saying, "You have to find the balance. It's like you're walking a tightrope between technique and music." She remembered Ainsley saying, "Yes, but at some point, you just have to let go." She lifted her bow. She let go. Chapter 88. The Night of the Barbecue. Pam and Martin pulled up in front of Erica and Oliver's neat-looking little bungalow. "Holly might be asleep by now," said Pam to her husband. It was nearly 9 o'clock.
"Might be," said Martin. "Might not be."
"That must be where it happened," said Pam. She pointed at the big house next door with dislike. All those turrets and curlicues and spires. She'd always thought it was a fussy, show-offy sort of house.
"Where what happened?" said Martin blankly.
Sometimes she could swear he had early-onset dementia. "Where the accident happened," said Pam. "They were at the neighbour's house. They don't even know them that well, apparently."
"Oh," said Martin. He looked away from the house and undid his seatbelt.
"Right." They got out of the car and walked up the paved pathway with its neatly trimmed edges. "How do you feel?" she said to Martin.
"What? Me? I feel fine."
"I'm just making sure you don't have chest pains or anything, because it's times like this that people our age unexpectedly drop dead."
"I don't have chest pains," said Martin. "Do you have chest pains? You're a person of our age too."
"I play tennis 3 times a week, said Pam primly.
"I'm more worried about our son-in-law dropping dead of a heart attack," said Martin, shoving his hands in his pockets.
He looked terrible. He was right. Sam had looked absolutely terrible at the hospital. It didn't seem possible that one event
could have such a profound physical effect on a person. They'd seen Sam just yesterday, when he dropped by to help Martin move out their old washing machine, and he'd been in great form, chatting about Clementine's audition, some plan he had to help her get over her nerves, excited about his new job. But tonight, he'd looked like he'd been rescued from somewhere, like those people you saw on the news wrapped in silver blankets, with red-rimmed eyes and a ghost-white pallor. He was in terrible shock, of course.
"You were very rough on Clementine," said Martin mildly, as Pam pressed the doorbell and they heard its distant chime.
"She should have been watching Ruby," said Pam.
"For Christ's sake, it could have happened to anyone," said Martin.
"Not me," thought Pam.
"And they both should have been watching," said Martin. "They made a mistake and they very nearly paid a terrible price.
People make mistakes."
"Well, I know that." But in Pam's eyes, it was Clementine's mistake. That's why she was battling this terrible, unmotherly sense of rage towards her beloved daughter. She knew it would eventually recede. She sure hoped it would. And that she'd probably feel just awful about the way she'd spoken to her at the hospital. But for now, she still felt very, very angry. It was the mother's job to watch her child. Forget feminism, forget all that. Pam would scream about equal pay from the rooftops, but every woman knew you couldn't rely on a man to watch the children in a social situation. It was scientifically proven that they couldn't do two things at the same time. Clementine had always been too prepared to rely on Sam, but just because she was a musician, a creative person, an artist, didn't give her the right to relinquish her responsibilities as a mother. Her job as a mother came first. Sometimes Clementine got the identical, distracted, dreamy expression on her face as Pam's dad used to get at the dinner table while Pam was trying to tell him something, and she wouldn't even have finished the sentence before he'd wandered off. He might have been Ernest Bloody Hemingway for all Pam cared. All that time he'd spent writing that novel no one would ever read, ignoring his children, locking himself away in his study, when he could have been living. It could have been a masterpiece, Clementine always said, as if it was a tragedy, as if that was the point, when it wasn't the point. The point was that Pam never got a father, and Pam would have quite liked a father. Just every now and then. What good did it do Ruby if her mother was the best cellist in the world? Clementine should have been watching. She should have been listening. She should have been concentrating on her child. Of course, Clementine's music had nothing to do with what happened today. She did know that. If Ruby didn't make it through the night, if she suffered some sort of long-term damage to her health, Pam didn't know what she'd do with all this anger. She'd have to find the strength to put it aside to be there for Clementine. Pam put her hand to her chest. Ruby was stable, she reminded herself. That rosy little plump-cheeked face, those wicked, slanting, cat-like eyes.
Pam, said Martin.
What? She snapped. He was studying her closely.
You look like you're having a heart attack.
Well, I'm not, thank you very much. I'm perfectly...
The door swung open, and Oliver stood there, wearing tracksuit bottoms and a T-shirt.
Hello, Oliver.
Pam hadn't seen him in casual clothes before. Normally, he wore a nice checked shirt tucked into trousers. Pam had met him on so many occasions over the years, but she'd never really got to know him that well. He was always so complimentary about Pam's signature dish, her carrot and walnut cake. He seemed to have gotten it into his head that the cake was sugar-free, which was not the case, but she didn't bother to correct him. He was so skinny, a bit of sugar wouldn't hurt him. Holly is just through here, watching a movie, said Oliver. She would have been very welcome to stay the night with us, of course. He said this sadly.
Oh, she would have loved that, Oliver, said Pam. But we were all fighting over her, you see. It's a distraction from our worry over Ruby.
I understand you were the hero of the day, said Martin, and he held out his hand to Oliver.
Oliver went to take Martin's hand.
I don't know about...
But to Pam's surprise, her husband changed his mind about shaking hands at the last moment and instead threw his arms around Oliver in an awkward hug, thumping him on the back, probably much too hard.
Pam rubbed Oliver's arm gently to make up for Martin's thumping.
You are a hero, she said, her voice full of emotion. You and Erica are heroes. Once Ruby is home and feeling better, we'll have you over for a special dinner, a dinner fit for heroes. I'll make that carrot cake I know you like.
Oh, delicious, wow. That's very kind of you, said Oliver, stepping back and ducking his head like he was 14.
Where is Erica? Said Pam.
She's asleep, actually, said Oliver. She wasn't feeling quite right.
Probably the shock, said Pam. Everyone is feeling... Well, look who's here. Hello, darling. Look at those fairy wings.
Holly headed straight to her and buried her face in Pam's stomach.
Hello, Grandma, she said. I am exhausted.
She lifted her fingers in quotation marks. Her funny little habit. Right, said Oliver. I'll grab your rock collection, Holly.
No, I don't want it, said Holly, almost belligerently. I told you I don't want it. You keep it.
Well, I'll take care of it for you, said Oliver. If you change your mind, you can have it back.
Come to Grandpa, Holly.
Martin held out his arms to Holly, and she leapt up, her legs wrapped around his waist, her head on his shoulder. No point telling Martin not to carry her after his knee operation. He needed to carry her. Holly fell asleep in the car and didn't wake when Martin carried her in, or even when Pam changed her into a spare pair of pajamas she kept in the house. Martin didn't see the need to change her, but Pam knew you were always so much comfier in pajamas. But as Pam leaned to kiss her goodnight, Holly's eyes sprang open.
Is Ruby dead? She said.
She was lying on her front, her head turned sideways on the pillow, a tangle of hair obscuring her face.
No, darling, said Pam.
She lifted the hair off Holly's face and smoothed it back from her forehead. She's at the hospital. The doctors are looking after her. She's going to be fine. You go back to sleep. Holly closed her eyes, and Pam rubbed her back.
Grandma,
whispered Holly.
Yes, darling.
Pam was feeling tired herself now. Holly whispered something Pam couldn't hear.
What's that?
Pam leaned forward to listen.
Are Mummy and Daddy very, very angry with me?
Whispered Holly.
Of course not, said Pam. Why would they be angry with you? Because I pushed her.
Pam froze.
I pushed Ruby.
Said Holly again, louder. Pam's hand lay flat and still on Holly's back, and for a moment she didn't recognize it. It looked too old and wrinkled to belong to her.
She took my bag of rocks, said Holly. She was standing on the side of the fountain with my bag, and she wouldn't let me have it, and it's mine.
and I was trying to get it off her, and then I got it, and I pushed her, because I felt really, really angry.
Oh, Holly.
I didn't mean for her to be drowned. I thought she would chase after me. Will she go to heaven? I don't want her to go to heaven.
Did you tell anyone? Asked Pam.
Oliver,
mumbled Holly into the pillow, as if she were worried that was also a transgression.
I told Oliver.
What did Oliver say? Said Pam.
He said, when I see Ruby at the hospital, I should whisper, sorry, very quietly in her ear, and that I should never, ever push her again.
Ah, said Pam.
He said it was our secret, and he would never tell anyone in the whole world, ever, said Holly.
He was a lovely man, Oliver, a good man, trying to do the right thing. But what if Holly never got that chance to whisper sorry in Ruby's ear? Ruby was stable. Ruby would not die in the night. But if she did die, Pam refused to have her beautiful, innocent granddaughter pay the price for Clementine's inattention.
You know what? I don't think she fell in when you pushed her, she said firmly. That probably happened later, after you ran away. She probably slipped. I think she slipped.
I know she slipped. She fell, darling. You did not push her. I know you didn't. You were having a little argument over the bag by the fountain, and poor Ruby fell in. It was just an accident. You go to sleep now.
Holly's breathing slowed.
You just put it right out of your mind, she said. It was an accident. A terrible accident. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't really anyone's fault.
She kept rubbing Holly's back in ever-increasing circles, like the endless ripples created by a tiny pebble thrown in still water. And as she did, she talked and talked, making the memory disappear, just like the ripples. And the funny thing was that she could feel her anger toward Clementine ebbing away, as if she'd never felt it in the first place. Chapter 89. 4 months after the barbecue. Clementine walked back from the letterbox, shuffling their mail, and got to a plain white envelope addressed to her. It was Erica's handwriting. She stopped in the middle of her footpath, studying that familiar, cramped scrawl. Erica wrote as if she needed to conserve space. Had she put it in the mail yesterday, just before she'd left for the airport? Erica and Oliver had flown out yesterday morning for a 6-month trip. They'd both taken leave without pay from their jobs and bought around-the-world tickets. They were flexible with their plans, or flexible for them, as in there were some nights where they hadn't yet booked accommodation. Crazy stuff. When they got back, they were hoping to become long-term foster carers. They'd already begun the approval process when, all of a sudden, Erica had announced, by email, not a phone call, that they were going to travel first. According to Clementine's mother, they hadn't made any particular arrangements about Sylvia. If the neighbours called the police when the house got too bad, so be it.
That's exactly what she said to me, Pam told Clementine. So be it. I nearly fell off my chair.
Of course, Clementine's parents were going to keep an eye on Sylvia.
She could have asked me to look in on Sylvia, Clementine had said. And her mother said, after a pause, as if she were considering her words, "She knows how busy you are." Her friendship with Erica had been changing, shifting somehow. Weeks could go by without contact, and when Clementine called, Erica would inevitably take a few days to call back. It was like she was distancing herself. In fact, it was almost as though, and this seemed incredible, ironic, impossible, but it was almost as though Erica was letting Clementine down gently. She was behaving the way a kind boy behaves when he wants to let a girl know that he likes her as a friend, but nothing more. Clementine was being demoted to a lower tier level of friendship, and she was accepting this with the strangest mix of feelings. Amusement, relief, maybe a touch of humiliation, and a definite sense of melancholy. She opened the envelope. There was a short note. "Dear Clementine, I got you a copy of this old photo Mum found. Mum says it's proof. I think she means of her great parenting. I thought it might give you a laugh. See you in 6 months. Love, Erica." What photo? She'd forgotten to include the photo. But then, as Clementine shook the envelope, a tiny square floated toward the ground, and she caught it. It was a black and white photo of herself and Erica and Sylvia on a roller coaster at Luna Park, caught at the moment they plunged over its highest precipice. Clementine remembered how staggered she'd been when Erica's mother had pulled them out of school that day. How did she do it? Some story she invented. Sylvia could get away with anything. Clementine had been drunk with happiness. It was outrageous. It was living. She remembered how Erica had been as excited as her, what fun they'd all had, until toward the end of the day, when Erica's mood inexplicably changed. On the way home, she got herself all worked up about a missing library book. "I know exactly where it is," Sylvia kept saying. And Erica said, "You do not, you do not." Clementine, in her innocence, wondered why it was such a big deal. The library book would turn up, surely. After all, Sylvia never threw anything out. "Stop spoiling it, Erica," she'd thought resentfully. Clementine could relish the anarchy of that day because she was going home to order and cleanliness, to spaghetti bolognese and school bags packed the night before. She looked closely at the photo, studying Erica's face, the pure, almost sensual abandonment with which she'd thrown back her head, laughing, screaming, her eyes closed. There was a secret wildness to Erica. It came out so rarely. She kept it under wraps. Maybe Oliver got to see it. It was like that dry, subversive sense of humour that occasionally slipped out almost by mistake. As Clementine walked back inside studying the photo, she wondered what sort of person Erica could have been, would have been, should have been, if she'd been given the privilege of an ordinary home. You could jump so much higher when you had somewhere safe to fall. "What's that? What are you looking at?" asked Holly as Clementine walked in the door. Clementine held the photo up high, away from snatching tiny fingers. "Nothing," she said. She looked again at the letter and saw that Erica had scrawled something in the bottom corner. "P.S. Just heard the news. Well done, Dumkopf. Knew you would." "Is it something precious?" Holly used her fingers to give emphasis. Precious was the word of the moment.
Yes, said Clementine. She looked at the tiny photo again. She'd have to keep it somewhere safe. It would be so easy to lose. It's something precious.
Acknowledgements. Thank you so much to everyone at Pan Macmillan, with special thanks, as always, to the wonderful Kate Patterson, as well as to Matilda Imlar, Brianne Collins, Tracy Cheatham, and Lara Wallace. Thank you also to my editors in the US and the UK, Amy Einhorn and Maxine Hitchcock. Since becoming an author, I've been so amazed at how kind people are when it comes to sharing their expert knowledge for fictional purposes. Thank you to Fenella for giving so incredibly generously of her time and expertise. Thank you to Rowena McNeish for patiently answering questions about life as a cellist, and to Kat Seekins for answering questions about her former life as a dancer. Thank you to Chris Jones for answering my medical questions. As this is a book about neighbours, I would like to note that I was put in touch with Chris by his parents, Sue and Ken Jones, the loveliest next-door neighbours you could ever hope to have. Thank you, Liz Friesel, for answering my uneducated musical questions. All mistakes are sadly mine, and mine alone. Thank you to my friends and fellow authors, Burr Carroll and Diane Blacklock, for their friendship and support with this novel. Thank you to my lovely literary agent, Fiona Inglis, as well as my US and UK agents, Faye Bender and Jonathan Lloyd. Thank you to Jerry Kalagian for my entry into the wonderful world of Hollywood. Thank you to Mum, Dad, Jackie, Katie, Fiona, Sean and Nicola, with special thanks to Katie and Fiona for help with proofreading, and to Fiona for that sentence I stole. Thank you to Adam, George and Anna for being you. I'm so lucky I got the three of you. Thank you to Anna Cooper for everything you've done for our family. Two characters in this book are named after people in the real world. Stephen Lunt was the winning bidder at the Get In Character fundraising auction run by Click Sargent Cancer Support for the Young. Robin Byrne was the winner of the Be Immortalised in Fiction competition at the Sisters in Crime Australia Davitt Awards. I've dedicated this book to my sister, the amazing novelist Jacqueline Moriarty, because I couldn't have finished this book without her help and support. Actually, I know I wouldn't have finished any of my books without Jackie. The following books were helpful to me in my research about hoarding. Dirty Secret, A Daughter Comes Clean About Her Mother's Compulsive Hoarding, 2011, by Jessie Scholl, and Coming Clean, A Memoir, by Kimberly Ray Miller, 2014. The website, www.childrenofhoarders.com, was also a great resource. Belinda hopes you enjoyed the reading of Truly, Madly, Guilty, written by Leanne Moriarty and read by Caroline Lee. Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. We're sure they'll love you for it. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.